Welcome and hello. Thank you for joining me today. This is History's Great Mysteries, and I'm your host, Nick, a show where I take a look and examine some of the most baffling events of human history in a way that leaves you, the listener, with the information able to form your own opinions on what happened. And today is indeed no different, as today I ask that you pay close attention and try to channel your inner Sherlock Holmes, because today we have a true mystery on our hands. A mystery that definitely has the potential to be solved, we just need to put some of the final puzzle pieces into place. Today we talk about a disappearance, but not just any disappearance. Probably the most known and influential disappearance in American history. Not only that, the scenario leading up to the disappearance is something straight out of a blockbuster Hollywood action movie that's almost too incredible to be true, but this actually happened. And it really is awe-inspiring. Today, I will lay out the series of events that culminated into the highest profile airplane hijacking in the world. Listen in and let's dive into the legendary disappearance of D.B. Cooper. The year is 1971 in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, and November 24th began like any other day for the airline workers in Portland, Oregon. Nothing seems awry, and then an unassuming man dressed in a business suit walks in and buys a one-way ticket to Seattle with cash on flight 305, a flight scheduled to be flown by a Boeing 727. On his ticket voucher, he writes the name Dan Cooper. Later, he would be described as ranging from 35 to 50 years old, Caucasian, medium build, dark brown hair, and wearing sunglasses. Wholly unremarkable, you might say. So, eventually, the plane is boarded, the crew prepares to take off, and our Mr. Cooper gets a seat in the very back of the airplane, apparently with an entire row to himself. Now, as was common, the flight attendant would sit in the back of the plane as well to facilitate the boarding process. And much of what we know comes from this first flight attendant and then the subsequent flight attendant that I'll talk about in a bit. From flight 305 that day, this first one is Miss Florence Schaffner. According to her testimony, he seemed normal enough. He was smoking cigarettes because, you know, you could back then, and at one point he actually ordered a bourbon and coke, while some of the other passengers were getting finished boarding. However, things quickly turned from normality when the captain announced that they would begin their departure. At this point, shortly after liftoff, our mysterious Mr. Cooper turns around to Miss Schaffner and hands her a handwritten note. Now, this note was never recovered, as Mr. Cooper kept it with him afterwards, but Mrs. Schaffner remembers it saying something along the lines of, "I have a bomb, sit next to me." So in response, Schaffner sits inconspicuously next to the man and starts to have a conversation. The first thing that happens is Mr. Cooper opens his briefcase to reveal something awfully reminiscent of a bomb. There's like red cylinders all attached to wires, you know, very convincing stuff in the eyes of Miss Schaffner, who takes this and says, yep, it's pretty high chance that this actually is a bomb. There's no reason to doubt it right now. But she doesn't scream, she doesn't make any kind of fuss, really. And to anyone who's like looking on, it would just look like a man and a flight attendant, you know, having a calm conversation. In reality, Mr. Cooper is then instructing her of his demands. So what he says is that I want $200,000 in American cash, all in 20s. I want four parachutes, two primary and two reserve chutes, and then I want a fuel truck on the runway ready to refuel once we land. Then he apparently said word for word, no funny stuff or I'll do the job. So keeping her composure, Ms. Schaffner walks to the cockpit and relays all of this information to the rest of the crew. And the crew all kind of decides that they should probably comply with this Mr. Cooper in the back of the plane. And they do all of this without warning the passengers on the flight of the situation. Again, there's, you know, hundreds of innocent passengers on this flight. At this point, another flight attendant by the name of Tina Mucklow joins Mr. Cooper in his row And then she brings with her this like inline telephone that's, you know, connected to the back of the plane so that they could communicate to the crew in the cockpit. And so for the rest of the flight, this is kind of how it operated. They would sit in the back row, Mr. Cooper and Mrs. Mucklow, and relay instructions back to the cockpit. And through this, he had kind of effectively taken full control of the plane. It was like a true hijacking, and it was one of the first of its kind. Like, you kind of hear about this, and you're like, yeah, you know, a typical hijacking. But he was like the first guy to do it. It was this that kind of made the whole idea popular in movies and TV shows and whatnot. So anyways, back in the cockpit, they understand the situation and, you know, they're treading carefully. Of course, they radio back down to the tower and they give a full rundown on what's going on. And this is where the police and the FBI really get involved in the situation. And you have to consider what must be going through their heads here. We have like an otherwise normal commercial flight, hundreds of innocent passengers with some man in the back claiming to have a bomb. And on the surface, this is extremely scary, right? However, this man seems to be, you know, maybe like reasonable, but okay, that's not really the best word to use. Maybe he seems like he's moving somewhat predictably. He's not on edge. He's not erratic. So in their minds, perhaps, you know, if they do arrange to meet his demands, he really would follow through with his side of the bargain and, you know, not blow up the plane. So furthermore, he indicated that he wanted to, you know, land the plane, receive the money, the parachutes, and a refuel, which then points to the idea that he wants to take off again afterwards. He wants to fly again, right? So maybe it's possible here to get the passengers off the flight during this refuel time and then maybe work from there. So, and then, you know, also you have to consider, like, yes, while $200,000 is a lot of money back then, it's not like an unthinkable amount of money. It's not unfathomable. So, like, the FBI, if they could get out of this whole situation, keeping everyone alive and then only losing out on $200,000, they wouldn't really be feeling too bad about themselves. So soon thereafter, the authorities have come to an agreement, which they then relay to the captain, and then from there is relayed back to Mr. Cooper. The demands will be met. They just need to land safely at the Seattle-Tacoma airport with the money, the parachutes, and the refueling all ready to go. So while they get all this stuff together, Flight 305 proceeds to fly circles around the airport, vying for time. A local bank ends up getting the money together, while a local skydiving school provides the parachutes. It is also around this time while circling the airport that Mr. Cooper mentioned something a little strange to Miss Tina Mucklow. And this strange thing is the fact that while he's looking out at the terrain beneath, he apparently muttered something about the Seattle airport being 20 minutes away from the McCord Air Force Base, which, you know, could be seen below. Now, what exactly this means, we will get into a bit later. So anyways, at around sunset, Flight 305 finally lands in Seattle, which, and at that point, they then taxi to a far corner of the airport for the arrangement to be carried out. The crew continues their conversation with Mr. Cooper, asking, you know, what should happen next, and Mr. Cooper informs them that he will then allow the passengers to leave the plane, but that most of the crew should stay on board. He also tells the flight attendants to lower every single shade on the windows, which apparently was an effort to deter snipers. And in hindsight, this was actually a stroke of brilliance because the FBI had indeed lined the airport with snipers that, you know, at that point had then become ineffective and impractical when the window shades were lowered. He then orders Tina Mucklow next to him to go out onto the tarmac to collect his ransom money and his parachutes. She does as instructed and returns these items to him. Meanwhile, the refueling truck is working through some difficulties and delays, you know, quote-unquote difficulties, to get the airplane ready to go, because it would be later divulged that these delays from the refueling truck were actually intentional, as the authorities scrambled, you know, searching for ideas and opportunities to resolve the situation. But it seemed that nothing substantial was coming to mind. The authorities really only played a couple of cards from their hand. Firstly, and obviously, the serial numbers on each of these $20 bills was marked, and this meant that this money could then be tracked if it were ever spent. Secondly, two military fighting jets were in the air and ready to track the 727 once it took off again. So back at the scene, the delays apparently had made Mr. Cooper quite agitated. While the pilot was trying to iron out the plans as, you know, where he wanted to go, all Mr. Cooper says and really cares about is, quote, getting this show on the road, spoken like a true-to-character middle-aged white man. So All that the crew can really get from him is that he wants to go to Mexico City. However, Mr. Cooper does get very specific about a few other things with regards to the plane. Firstly, Mr. Cooper demands that they keep the flaps up at 15 degrees, the landing gears down, the speed low, altitude below 10,000 feet, and that the rear exit staircase be lowered during the flight. Most of these things are indeed, you know, agreed upon by the crew, but they say that the rear exit cannot be lowered during takeoff. So Mr. Cooper turns to Ms. Mucklow and asks her to show him how to open the rear exit stairs once the plane is in flight, which she then does show him. It is around this time that something rather panic-inducing occurs when an unwitting passenger who was aboard the flight runs back across the tarmac to apparently retrieve something that he had left on the plane. And you have to admire this. I mean, the crew kind of went through this whole flight without letting most of the passengers know what was actually going on, enough to the point where this guy was like, oh crap, I forgot something on the plane, and then runs back to this hijacked plane to go grab it, right? And you can only imagine the utter fear that the authorities must have felt at this. Like, if this guy runs onto the plane and Mr. Cooper mistakes his intentions, like, oh, he's here to kill me or something, he could just blow up the plane right there. And yes, while the passengers have left, the authorities still don't want to blow up this innocent crew, so they're maintaining their caution here. But as I understand it, this retrieval by the passenger went off without incident, and eventually the refueling was done, and there was nothing really left to do except to continue to meet his demands. And, oh, and there is a little fun fact here. The three crew members that were in the cockpit, they could have easily actually escaped down a secret little rope ladder at this point, but they all actually refused to do so because the flight attendant, Tina Mucklow, was still in the cabin with Mr. Cooper, and they didn't want to abandon her. And it was, you know, a very delicate situation, and everyone feared that at any moment, you know, Mr. Cooper might detonate the bomb at the first sight or, you know, of quote-unquote funny business. So after the long delay and with no clever scheme devised, they have to get the plane back up in the air. Now, it's also important to mention that the four parachutes that were given to Mr. Cooper, the two front chutes and then the two reserve chutes, they were all of different types. One of the primary chutes was labeled as a luxury civilian type chute, while the other one was an old, technically inferior, and a non-steerable military chute. And these reserve chutes as well, one of them was actually in the haste that the skydiving school, got these chutes together. They actually accidentally gave one of the reserve chutes as like a dummy chute that like didn't work at all. And then the other one really was a reserve chute. But you know, obviously these are the reserve chutes. It doesn't really technically matter all that much as long as the primary works. And so it was actually really interesting to see, of these four chutes, which ones did he pick? It could tell a lot about this man, and you know, we'll get into that later when we go over the suspects and the theories here. But you know, after everything was in order, the plane was back in the sky at around 7:40 p.m. and this time headed south towards Mexico City with a brief pit stop planned in Reno, Nevada. At this point, Mr. Cooper is making his final preparations for a grand escape. Ms. Mucklow repeatedly asked him if there was anything she could do to help. And much of what we know of Mr. Cooper's final movements aboard the airplane come from the first few minutes of this flight. Ms. Mucklow watched Mr. Cooper open up a reserve chute, the dummy chute in fact, and tear it up into a makeshift bag for carrying all of his cash. She pointed out where he could find the oxygen if he needed it, but to this he said he already knew where it was. Mr. Cooper then instructs Mucklow to leave him and go into the cockpit with the other crew members. The last thing she saw before closing the cockpit door is Mr. Cooper standing in the aisle, seemingly wrapping the parachute around him, preparing to jump. It was a couple minutes later, at 7:42, that a light in the cockpit came on indicating that the rear exit stairway was open, indicating that Mr. Cooper had indeed succeeded in opening it as he had intended. Over the intercom, the crew members radioed in to ask if everything was all right, to which Mr. Cooper said yes. And this was the last word anyone heard from the mysterious hijacker. A bit later, the crew noticed some heavy and strange oscillations of the aircraft, and all preceding attempts to communicate with Mr. Cooper was met with eerie silence. Following the plan, the pilot landed the 727 in Reno with the aft stairway still lowered, creating, you know, huge scene of sparks, and it actually damaged the stairway, but otherwise, the landing was completely safe and uneventful. When the FBI and the local police boarded the plane, they found a completely empty cabin, with the hijacker nowhere in sight. And much to their dismay, the crime scene was mostly devoid of clues as well. The only physical things left behind were his cheap necktie, his cigarette butts, and then a couple of those parachutes that were left behind. Of course, the cabin was thoroughly swept, fingerprints were taken from every surface that he might have touched, and you know, hair samples were also taken from his seat. Now, at this point in the podcast, you guys are probably thinking, well, man, there's like 100 ways that we could find this Mr. Cooper, right? Track the DNA, get a sketch, start a profile. He must have jumped, find where he dropped, track the money, track the name. And, you know, listener, you would be correct in most cases, but this is definitely not most cases. And let's discuss this. First off, the name Dan Cooper that he gave on his ticket was most definitely a fake name. So this couldn't really lead to anything solid. The military jets that were following the 727 that night never saw Mr. Cooper jump either. And, you know, because it occurred at night and it's all dark, it's understandable as to how they missed him. And, okay, so then you say, well, go to where he must have landed then. And that would work, but that would only actually work if we knew when he jumped. But we don't precisely know. We know that the rear stairway was opened. It was opened at 7:42, but when did he jump from it, right? And that drastically changes when or where he might have landed. You know, in addition to winds and anything else, there was a huge, huge buffer area to where he could have landed. And so to say, okay, we need to go look right here, you know, you're looking for a needle in a haystack at that point. And also with the nature of parachute descent, right, in this like storm that was going on at the time, any kind of difference in winds could have pushed him off course, off of like any kind of designated landing zone miles, right? And that's something that I actually didn't really mention, is that it, you know, it was nighttime, but it was also very stormy. There was a thunderstorm, rainstorm. It was -7 degrees Celsius outside, or 19 degrees Fahrenheit. So even if they wanted to go look at some sort of area that they think he might have landed, they couldn't really do it until the next morning when weather would allow. Which it was done. They did thoroughly conduct a search in this area that they designated as his probable landing zone, right? And in that morning and in the weeks that followed looking for this, they found absolutely nothing. No trace of Mr. Cooper. And then you maybe ask, okay, well, what about the DNA at the scene? What about the fingerprints, right? The hair. And these had a few problems. Firstly, the fingerprints, the hair, everything that they collected from the scene never could actually be like definitively tracked or definitively say, okay, this fingerprint belonged to Mr. Cooper. This hair belonged to Mr. Cooper. You couldn't really do that, right? So everything had a little bit of doubt going into it. And then you look at these cigarette butts. Those most definitely belong to Mr. Cooper, right? And that, for many people, is like, okay, that's where we need to get our DNA from. That's how we're going to track this guy down. But guess what? The cigarette butts were lost in evidence and completely mishandled, along with some of the other DNA that was mishandled. And then, you know, you look back at it 40 years into the future now, this DNA is just so mishandled, so unreliable, that it was completely, you know, almost impossible to draw any kind of conclusions from DNA. So that kind of X's that one out as well. So a sketch was indeed drawn of what this guy looked like, right? Because people got really good looks at him for hours on end. And there were actually several sketches done. And I will post these sketches on my Facebook page as well, so you guys can take a look at it. And you have to remember too, he did wear sunglasses for most of this hijacking. So that, mixed with his relatively, you know, plain-ish appearance, kind of made it difficult to say, well, you know, he had a huge scar across his cheek. Like, no, there's nothing like that. Like, he kind of looks like any middle-aged white guy, to be honest. Like, just these sketches didn't really give anything solid to go on. So it was actually kind of hard to follow a trail through only his appearance. And to make a very, very long story short, the exhaustive and grueling massive-scale manhunt slash search party that went on for the next several weeks found absolutely nothing. Mr. Cooper was projected to have landed in a densely wooded expanse north of Portland, but obviously because it was such tough wilderness, it was hard to search this area. And they weren't even entirely sure what they were looking for either. You know, money, pieces of clothing, maybe pieces of a parachute, maybe there's a man still hiding somewhere, Maybe they're looking for a dead body, but suffice to say, they found absolutely none of these things. And after weeks of fruitless searching, of course, the public and the media had sunk their teeth into the story. And, you know, this fire, this flame is growing hotter every day that nothing's found. The mystery grows every day that nothing is found, because it's becoming increasingly possible that he got away with this. This mysterious hijacker had pulled off the impossible and escaped scot-free. And, you know, the media loved it. And it's also a side note with the media that this case is known as the D.B. Cooper case, but that's actually due to a misprint in the newspapers, because if you remember, he put his name down as Dan Cooper. But this case is known as the D.B. Cooper case, and that's really because the media got it wrong. There was like this, the original article that got it really popular kind of misquoted his name as D.B. Cooper, and then it just stuck from there, and we can't get rid of it now. So that's why I'm calling him like Mr. Cooper for this episode, to avoid like any kind of confusion. But anyways, back to the case. So the authorities, after failing in their search, just started hoping that the marked bills would pop up somewhere. You know, if a cafe or a restaurant somewhere came up with one of these marked bills, it was possible to track Mr. Cooper from there and then perhaps finally apprehend him. But this too never happened. And as years passed, and then another year, and then five, and it just kind of seemed like, you know, the case couldn't be colder. But then the impossible happened. And something that just no one really saw coming. Some of the money had been found under incredibly bizarre circumstances. In February 1980, so almost a decade after the original hijacking, a young boy was playing near the water's edge of the Columbia River in northern Portland on a river called, or a river bank called Tina Bar, when he ran into something very peculiar. He was digging in the sand and found several big bundles of money, you know, rubber banded together, and it was severely degraded, but still definitely recognizable as $20 bills. He called over his parents, who collected this money and then reported it to authorities. And sure enough, the serial numbers of these $20 bills indeed matched some of the money of the original $200,000 that had originally been given to Mr. Cooper. And this money that was found, it only totaled to about $5,880. That obviously left out most of the money. It's still mostly unaccounted for, but this was still huge. This was the first real clue in over a decade. But, you know, what does it mean? The money was found over 25 kilometers from the suspected drop zone that they originally scoured years earlier. And are we meant to believe that this money floated its way through the river system north of Portland and then wound up there, buried in the San Tina Bar? That's obviously what it looks like, right? But the problem here is that the river, the only river that's running through that projected drop zone, could not have delivered the money there, quite simply because it flows in the opposite direction, away from Tina Bar. So, what the heck? How did the money get there, right? Either the original searches were completely off and he landed somewhere else entirely, or the money was put there after the fact, okay? So, if he died, right, on impact, and this money kind of just worked its way into the river system and then wound up there, what we're saying is that he must have landed somewhere way far away from the drop zone, which is an interesting approach, because it would have meant that the original decades ago search was completely wrong. And they did, you know, search this new possible drop zone after finding this money, but then again, found nothing. So that kind of came up empty. And then you have this other side of the coin. It's like, okay, was it put there, right? And this is interesting, because this area of Tina Bar, it was known that in 1974, there was a dredging operation, essentially, that picked up all of this sand, right? And if the dredging happened in 1974, and then you go there and you find this bundle of money in the sand after 1974, it means, right, that logically, that the money was put there after 1974. So a lot of people were like, holy crap, this proves it. He did survive. He did come back later and bury it on purpose years later, right? That's the only way that this is possible. And for a long time, people really, really, really believed this. And right when you think you have the answers, it comes out in 2009 that, nope, that original thought was incorrect. The dredging operation did not actually touch that area where the money was found, indicating, again, that it could have been washed ashore there at any point. But then wait, even further research, also conducted in 2009, showed that the type of rubber band that these bills were wrapped in could not withstand exposure to open air or open water for more than a year, or else they completely degrade. Which then cast doubt on the idea that this had somehow, you know, been completely protected from the elements for roughly an entire decade. You know, maybe this then points back to the idea that, okay, somehow, somewhere, it was deliberately buried into the sand where it was protected from the, you know, from the outside world, and then that's why they're still in decent condition. But even then, this isn't a definitive answer because the jury is still out on if this, you know, money was floating in the river and then immediately got buried in the sand and was protected enough that it didn't spend a year out in the weather, or if it was protected and then buried. You know, that there's so many different angles you could take on this, and all of this research kind of just brings you back to the, well, it could be a lot of things, and there's really no consistent. The jury is still out on what this find at Tina Bar really means for the case. And flash forward to present day, the case is still unsolved, with no consensus on what happened to the mystery man, Dan Cooper, or even who he was in the first place. In fact, this event is literally the only unsolved airline hijacking case to date. So, through all this information, have you guys come to your own conclusions? What was the fate of this daring mid-air hijacking? Did he survive and make a great escape $200,000 richer, off to live the remainder of his days in anonymity? Did he have an accomplice on the ground who facilitated his escape? Did he die without pulling the chute? Did he land but was unable to escape from the vast wilderness on that cold night? Did a searcher come across the cache in the woods somewhere and kept it all instead of bringing it to light? And at the end of the day, who was this Dan Cooper to begin with? Like, where did he come from? How did he manage to pull this off? And what was the big motive behind this risky stunt? Of course, he wanted money, but at one point, Tina Mucklow remembers him saying that he also had a grudge. What could that mean? Well, get your thoughts in order, because I'm going to lay out some of the common theories around this case, along with some of the common suspects for the identity of Dan Cooper, followed at the end with my personal opinion of who and what we're dealing with. So these first theories I'll jump into here are just kind of the on-the-surface theories of, like, what happened to him. I'll get into the suspects a bit later. But first, a lot of people say, you know, what he did is he did survive the jump and never spent the money. Because, again, we have all of these marked bills that never show up, never are reported, never are tracked. And then we also have this money washing up on Tina Bar, indicating that at some point some of the money at least got into the water. And who's to say that it all didn't just, you know, get floated out to sea, and then that was just one bundle that ended up in the sand before it went out to the sea, and then at that point all the money's gone. A lot of people say that once he landed and he had all this money, he knew that he could never spend it, right? He has all these marked bills. He must have known he couldn't spend it, and rather than just bring it along and risk getting caught with it, he just throws it in the river maybe. And you have to say, like, when you're considering the idea that he survived this daring escape, there were no one of the first things the FBI did is, like, they looked at missing person report, right? If they suspected, they had always suspected that he died on this jump, right? Then what would happen is, if you have this guy that's just all of a sudden dead, then obviously there's going to be some missing persons report, right? If he has a family or a job and all of a sudden he's not there, if they could connect a missing person report to him, to this Dan Cooper, then bam, you have your hijacker. But there never was any missing person report on that weekend that matched with him at all, which means that, okay, maybe he did survive and then he went back to work on Monday, right? Like, he might have gotten out of this, like, with no injury, no huge bodily injury, and was never reported missing because of it. And that's very probable in my mind, to be honest. This whole idea that he never really spent the money, it's possible. It's hard for me to believe that he jumped. He went through all of this only to overlook the fact that he probably wouldn't really be able to spend the money in America like he wanted to. I don't really know. That kind of seems like just a convenient cop out to finish connecting the dots on this theory. But some people say that he did survive and then he moved completely with the money still in hand. Maybe he moved to a different country. Like, we know he wanted to go to Mexico City, right? So maybe he ended up going all the way back to Mexico. Maybe he went up to Canada. Maybe he went to some random country where it would be really hard to track this money, because there are a lot of countries out there that aren't America that do accept American currency. And once you're out of the country, you know, the FBI's ability to track these bills with businesses and things that are out of their control is much harder to do. And maybe he knew that. Maybe that was the intention the entire time. And with this theory, you know, he completely succeeded in this hijacking. He got away with roughly $200,000. Now, what this doesn't really explain is why we found some money at Tina Bar on that riverbank. But I'll get into more on this when it comes to my theory. Obviously, we have the FBI's side of this, in that he died like during or directly after his fall. You know, we have to consider the fact that he did jump into like a storm on a pretty cold night into the pitch black, you know, into a huge wilderness area, in not the proper clothing, you know, to say the least. He didn't have a helmet on. He was wearing a business suit with like loafers. Like, he was not prepared for this jump. But in some respects, it's not like we expected him to be prepared for this jump. Like, he was playing the part of the hijacker. He was wearing this suit. That's kind of what he intended to do. And I don't really look at that and say, well, that's why he didn't survive. Like, that's just why it may have been harder for him to survive, but that's not a reason why he didn't successfully pull his chute. If he jumped into the air and somehow got disoriented and was not able to pull a chute, then yeah, he died on impact. And if he landed and then didn't survive the night, you know, why are we not finding a body? Why are we not finding a big colorful parachute out in the search zones that they searched, right? And even to this day, like, people go in that area all the time. Like, at some point, someone would have found something that matches it. And everyone knows the story in that area now. Like, something would have come up by now, but nothing. And so this whole died theory is easy to just say, yeah, that's what happened, and you don't really have to look any further than that. But man, there's just no evidence to support this idea at all. And you know, there's not a lot of evidence to support that he survived either, but until we have some, I don't really know if you can look at this one and say that this connects all the dots, because it really doesn't. And the last little theory I'll give here is the idea that he had an accomplice on the ground help him with this. And it has some merit in the idea that, you know, maybe that's how he made such a quick escape, is that he knew where he was jumping, he got there, had a friend in a car, got away scot-free, right? It's hard though to believe, because it is known, you know, from the pilot and from the other planes that were following him, that night it was really, really low visibility. Like, he was above the cloud line, which made it, I would say, absolutely impossible to know exactly what was beneath him. And it was nighttime anyways. Like, I don't think, and then it's also worth mentioning, and I was going to get into this a little bit later, but like I said, he did grab a non-steerable parachute, and he grabbed that over a parachute that was steerable. The luxury parachute that he didn't grab, that he left on the plane, was steerable, but not the one that he actually took, the military grade one. So the idea that he had a very specific landing point in the middle of the night, in the middle of the woods somewhere, for someone to pick him up is a little bit far-fetched for me. And even if it was, that's how it was planned out, maybe, I don't think that's what actually ended up like truly happening. 'Cause I don't think he had any kind of specific drop zone in mind. I think he was really just making a solo escape, at least in my mind. But anyways, we'll get on to the actual suspects, the people, the identities of who could be this Dan Cooper. The first suspect I'll talk about is a military veteran named Kenneth Christensen. And you will see the similarity with many suspects in this case, the fact that they must have had a military background. And this assumption is for several reasons. We have a man who has extensive knowledge about flight, air travel, existing knowledge on the workings of planes, you know, specifically Boeings, a man who knew the name of the military base near Seattle, and even gave an accurate time frame as to how long it would take to drive there, a man who pulled off a military-esque type escape from the back of a plane, and furthermore, a man who chose the military parachute over the more advanced parachute aboard the plane. In all accounts from the flight attendants, he knew exactly what he was doing when it came to, you know, interacting with the parachute. So yes, many assumed that he had military experience, but some also go further and insist that he must have had flight experience as well. And that goes to the show, you know, like he knew where the oxygen was on the plane. He knew about the getting the back row and then having the flight attendant being able to use that inline telephone. Like he knew all these specifics about the plane. And then not even to mention, you know, when he gave instructions, you know, flaps at 15 degrees, keep it below 10,000 so that they don't have to pressurize the cabin, stuff like that. He had a lot of knowledge. And some people say, yeah, this means he had to have had piloting experience or some sort of flight experience in some way. And this is where Kenneth Christensen becomes kind of the perfect storm. Not only was he a paratrooper in his military time, but he also worked as an airline mechanic and flight attendant for Northwest Airlines. He was left-handed, which many people think the D.B. Cooper must have been left-handed, because eyewitnesses actually describe him interacting with his briefcase using his left hand a majority of the time, and then more importantly, the clip-on tie that was found at the scene was affixed from the left side, which would only reasonably be worn by someone who was left-handed. He was 45 at the time of the hijacking, which fits with witness descriptions, and he also bore a heavily similar facial features to that of the hijacker, which Tina Mucklow herself verified the resemblance. However, the body type was not the same, and Kenneth Christensen was also balding at this time, a feature that most certainly was not present with D.B. Cooper. So perhaps a wig may have been used? We also noticeably lack a motive here. You know, there was also no reason to believe that he had any reason to do this within his own career field, nor any reason that he would desperately need $200,000 for some dire purpose. Although, to add to the mystery here, it has been stated by his brother that on his deathbed, Kenneth said, "There is something you should know, but I cannot tell you," hinting to some grand secret that many believe may have been a confession to being D.B. Cooper. The second suspect I will give you is that of William Smith, a man who was never actually listed by the FBI as an official suspect in the case. So how do we get to him? Well, it was actually very, very recently in 2018 that an anonymous data analyst identified him as D.B. Cooper. And this was for a myriad of reasons that all seemed to point towards its guilt. He, again, had a military background with experience in parachuting, who worked as a railroad yard master, and also almost perfectly matched the descriptions and sketches of Mr. Cooper. And when I say this, I really, really mean it. Like, you guys have to take a look at this for yourselves. The resemblance between the sketch and then a picture of William Smith is really uncanny. And there's even a sketch drawn of what Mr. Cooper would look like today, kind of in modern times, in his old age. And then when you compare that to a somewhat recent picture of William Smith, I mean, like, holy hell, these pictures, it almost looks like it was an intentional portrait drawing of William Smith. And again, I'll have the pictures and everything else on my Facebook page in the post for this episode. But anyways, yeah, we have this guy that matches the description, has the skill set, and maybe even had a motive, and that his railroad business was in extreme money problems in early 1970, which might give reason for the money grab, but also might give reason for the grudge, as perhaps he blamed the blooming airline industry for the decay that was being seen in the railroad industry. And then, most important of all, we have this curious little find upon the necktie that was left at the scene. So some recent examination through an electron microscope uncovered some interesting metallic particles, one of them being a sliver of pure titanium, which was, needless to say, very notable back then. You wouldn't find this on just like any normal necktie by many means, so what does this indicate? Well, many like to say that this points to the idea that Mr. Cooper must have worked at some sort of metal processing or chemical plant or even maybe a rail yard. And it's possible. If we were to believe that it was William Smith, perhaps he made his escape through knowledge of the train track systems throughout the United States and was able to hop aboard and exit off into the night. It all sounds really good, right? But there's one big problem with pinning William Smith as our guy, and that's the fact that he had spent his entire life living in the eastern United States. The hijacking not only took place on the West Coast, but almost certainly D.B. Cooper had extensive knowledge of the area based on his comments aboard the flight. But this doesn't necessarily spell doom for this theory. Maybe it was intentional. Maybe Smith wanted the crime to take place far away so that it would be harder to trace it all the way back to him on the other side of the country. And it is known that William Smith did have family in the Pacific Northwest, so maybe he just really did his homework in preparation for this job, and he made it seem like he was a local, but in reality, he just really studied up. Maybe. The next suspect I will get into here is a man by the name of Robert Rackstraw, probably the name thrown around the most when it comes to the D.B. Cooper hijacking. And frankly, this is because many believe him to be the most likely candidate for the culprit. Surprisingly, though, he wasn't taken seriously as a suspect in the investigation until the late 1970s, but since then, he has gained popularity, kind of coming to a peak in 2016 when the History Channel devoted a multi-part series to the D.B. Cooper incident and named Robert Rackstraw, as their highest probable suspect. And all of this heavy suspicion is for good reason. Rackstraw was a decorated military veteran with experience in piloting, explosives, and as a paratrooper. In his adult life after the military, he was a bit reckless, and he was not below breaking the law, for which he found himself in court more than a few times. On several occasions, he had been known to give aliases for various reasons, and he even had an uncle with the last name Cooper who was an experienced skydiver. Going further, the hijacking took place less than 5 months after Rackstraw was prematurely discharged from the military, a possible motive behind his comment that he had a grudge. Perhaps in his tribulations as a criminal following his military career, he was struggling for money and saw this as an opportunity. And, I mean, he has all this special, you know, incredible skills with extensive knowledge on how to actually pull something like this off. And, you know, with maybe nothing to lose, why not? Why not try it? And years later, as his popularity as a suspect grew, journalists and reporters would approach him and just straight up ask him if he was D.B. Cooper, and to this, he would never give a straightforward denial. He once even said something along the lines of, "It sounds like something I would do." But the connections to this case kind of end there for Rackstraw, in that he did not match the description of Dan Cooper really at all. He didn't have the right eyes, and even more importantly, he was only in his 20s at the time of the hijacking, while, you know, most of the crew and the other witnesses vehemently stand behind that he was in his 40s. And as we know, in crime, witnesses can be somewhat mistaken and, you know, unreliable when relaying information, but this is kind of a special case. I mean, we're talking about dozens of people here giving the same description, like, yeah, he's in his 40s, and many of whom, like the flight attendants, they were with him for hours. And in my mind, the description, if it doesn't match the suspect, it's honestly really kind of hard to surmise that it could have been D.B. Cooper. Because again, we have people who are getting really good looks at him. And if it doesn't match him, if the flight attendants go back and look at these suspects and say, well, that's not him, then like, for me, that's kind of the end of it. You can't get past that really, unless this guy was really good at disguises, but I don't know. And, you know, this is a bit of a personal angle, and to this day, many people maintain that, no, it was indeed Rackstraw aboard that flight, Flight 305, on that night. Robert Rackstraw recently passed away in July of 2019 without ever divulging a definitive answer. So the best we can do is try to draw more and more connections and see where it takes us, really. The last suspect I will name here is William Gossett. Again, here we have a decorated military veteran of the Korean and Vietnam Wars, who was a self-described daredevil and survivalist, who actually came forward and fully announced that he was the infamous D.B. Cooper. As far as the connections go, we do have Mr. Gossett located in the correct time and place to have carried out the hijacking. He does have the wherewithal, the temperament, and the confession going for him. When it comes to matching physical descriptions, it's honestly tough to be certain because Gossett never really came to the attention of the investigation until much later, and it's kind of hard to, you know, wind back the years and listen to reports about what he looked like back then and then try to imagine that and then try to put it next to the D.B. Cooper sketches, but from what I can gather, it's said that his description did at least show some similarities with that of Mr. Cooper. An article from Desert News covered the claim and said this: Gossett died in 2003 at the age of 73. His son said his father told him on his 21st birthday that he had hijacked the plane, then revealed to his son two keys to a safety deposit box at a bank in Vancouver, British Columbia, where the money was stored. And then the son said, that I could never tell anybody until after he died. And This honestly roused my suspicion a little bit because something about this case that people have tried to point out is that there are several clues that D.B. Cooper might have ties to Canada. Firstly, the name Dan Cooper is actually, get this, the name of a character in a Canadian comic book series titled Dan Cooper, who is a Canadian pilot, a daredevil, and a skydiver. And this comic book series was reportedly only in Canada at the time of the hijacking. Like, it wasn't in any other country. And if you remember back at the very beginning of the whole event, Mr. Cooper demanded $200,000 in American currency, which it at least seems a little odd, right? You're in America, and many people, you're presumably American. You're on a flight between two American cities. Why would you have to specify American currency when making your demands? So many, like I said, love to draw the conclusion to Canada in some way, shape, or form. And this William Gossett apparently had the money locked up in Vancouver. But through all of this, there's absolutely nothing linking Mr. Gossett to the crime scene. Literally, the only reason he's a suspect at all is because his sons came forward after his death and then told the press that he had confessed to them. So it's a lot of conjecture, and, you know, all of these claims have no backing, including the one about the safes in Vancouver that's never been verified. So while this too does have some promising leads, we are left a little short. And I feel like with every theory and every suspect, some of the dots are connected, but never all of the dots. And to be honest, that's because I think with the current beliefs that we have, we will never be able to connect all of them. So without further ado, I will divulge my theory behind this incident, behind who and what was behind the hijacking in 1971 over the Pacific Northwest. So what exactly happened up in the sky aboard Flight 305? Who was it? How did he pull it off? Why haven't we found the culprit? Well, it all boils down to false confidence, if you ask me, and let me explain. You have a man walk into an airport with the clear intention, the clear skill set, and the means to pull off a mid-air hijacking. He thought it all through. He gives a fake name, he creates a bomb, or at least a very convincing fake bomb, and he calmly and coolly takes control of the aircraft only minutes into the flight. He has extensive knowledge of how this is all going to work. He intentionally picked a seat at the back of the plane, next to the flight attendant and the telephone. And I assert that he even intentionally picked that exact flight because it was specifically a Boeing 727. It had the correct rear exit stairways from which he would make his eventual jump. He carefully gives details on what he wants, how he wants it. He asks for two parachutes because he wants to give authorities the impression that he intends to take a hostage. This, of course, is because he wants to deter their ideas of potentially sabotaging the parachute. Upon landing, he gets all the window shades pulled down in a successful effort to suppress the snipers that are stationed around the airport. And then once the parachutes are given to him, he selects the military chute because that's what he's familiar with, as I believe. He does indeed have a military background. And I say all this with such certainty in my voice to try to give you an idea of just how well prepared and skillfully he was pulling all of this off. I mean, he really truly had all of his bases covered. Like, he even gave specific numeric instructions to the pilot to have the flaps at 15 degrees and keep it below an altitude of 10,000. And like, he was trained, he was ready, he knew what to do every step of the way. And the problem with this whole investigation comes when the FBI immediately tells the press, oh, well, he died during his parachuting attempt. Like, what? How can you say, like, what about everything that led up to the jump gives you the impression that he couldn't handle landing a parachute without killing himself? I mean, sure, yeah, he wasn't properly dressed for the climate he was jumping into. He was wearing a business suit, but that was kind of part of his, you know, part of his outfit. He was playing the part. And he wasn't going to march, you know, into the helmet with 16 layers of outdoor clothing on fitted with survival gear. No, he carefully mapped out every detail, and he kind of took that risk that he wasn't going to be in the right outfit. And it's beyond me that the investigation thought that, like, his planning just stopped there. Like, everything is perfectly thought out, but the second he jumps from the plane, his plan just went to shit? Like, I don't think so. I think he continued his plan. He had everything planned even after he jumped. And that's why I think, that's why I wholeheartedly believe that he did indeed land safely on the ground. And it just doesn't make sense to me why the FBI would be so certain of his death. That is until you realize why they would want to push that narrative. You know, don't worry, public. He didn't get away with it. He's dead. We did our job. That's so much easier than saying, well, we searched high and low and found nothing. He must have escaped. That's scary. That means they failed, right? But by having someone dead with no money spent, you know, people are kind of like, okay, the FBI, like, did all right. But I don't think so. I think they pushed that narrative because they didn't do okay. They let him escape. He got away. And that's truly what I believed happened. I think he had everything planned, including like where he would land, how he would get out, how he would spend the money. And the reason that they found nothing is because there was nothing to find. He got out. He escaped. And like, even if he did have to spend the night in the woods out there, it was cold, but it wasn't like he's gonna die cold. Like, if he just wraps himself in his parachute under a tree, all, you know, bundled up close with his money, then he can get up in the morning and be on his merry way, in my mind. And this is where my theory might take a couple of turns. Now, how did that money end up in the sand of the Columbia River? Well, I think one of two things happened. I've established that he landed safely and was able to make his escape. But what did he do with the money? The first scenario is that he realized he could never safely spend his money. And, you know, he knows the bills are tracked. I already kind of went over this. Like, he came to this realization a little late, right? And once on the ground, he just decided he would dump the money into the river. And after watching it all float away, he kind of just turned his back and went home with one hell of a story to tell if he ever dare tell it. But the second scenario, I think, the more likely of the two, is that this man didn't live in the United States. I totally buy into the idea that he was a citizen of Canada, actually. I mean, we have the only Canadian, you know, Dan Cooper comic series where I think he must have gotten the name. And then you have this odd insistence that the money is American currency. And this all took place near Seattle in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, this is geographically right on the border of Canada. It's pretty easy to hop over, hop back once the job is done. And you know, if he managed to take the money with him into Canada, it would have been easier to get use out of it without, you know, without it being tracked, like I kind of already went over. The small amount of money that did up in the sand, in my mind, either got away from him while he was making the jump, or he intentionally put some of it into the water to perhaps give the illusion that he was dead or that, you know, the money would never be spent. And again, I'm erring on the side of he had it all planned out to a T. So this seems like, the second one seems like a more likely scenario. And who was it, you may ask? Who was D.B. Cooper? Well, I fully believe that the FBI never even got close. I believe that the real D.B. Cooper's name will never come up in talks or internet searches about this case. And that's because the FBI had it so wrong from the beginning. They were always so sure that Mr. Cooper died after the jump that I truly think they didn't put too much effort into identifying the right person. And through all the suspects that they did bring forward, many of which I did highlight earlier in the podcast, they still had heavy doubts. You know, none of them perfectly matched. Like, oh, this one didn't match the description, or this one was couldn't be linked to the right time, this one couldn't be linked to the right place, and etc., etc. No one that was brought forward checked all of the boxes. And that's because the true culprit was never brought forward, was never brought into the light. He fully, truly, 100% got away with this. And that's why I believe that the correct name will never be spoken in regards to this case. And as sad as it is, we are now so many years removed from this case. All the leads are cold, all the DNA evidence is lost in some way. That, you know, and then all the suspects are aged and dying. I just don't think we'll ever will put a name to the face. There would have to be like a huge overhaul, renewed interest, consideration of suspects that was never before considered, you know, perhaps new DNA evidence that was once lost is now recovered. And this would all have to happen to maybe reveal an identity. But even then, I chose this case for a reason. It truly is and will likely stay as one of history's greatest mysteries. Well, there we have it. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. It was a bit different in that through it all, my theory kind of centers on, well, we will never know kind of thing, which is kind of new for this podcast. I haven't really done that. I usually give a straightforward answer, but honestly, that's just the nature of this case. Like I said earlier, this is the only still outstanding unsolved case of airplane hijacking ever. And I think if things were handled differently from the beginning, we could have maybe got closer to solving it. But, you know, as they say, hindsight is always 20/20. But perhaps you guys have a different opinion. Maybe you are sure that it was someone else, maybe one of the suspects that I covered. Maybe you really did believe that he died after jumping, and, you know, maybe you believe there was an accomplice involved. I don't know. Whatever you believe, feel free to let me know over on my Facebook page. Anything else that you would like me to know as well, I always enjoy hearing from you guys. But at any rate, thank you again for listening in today. Your support means the world to me. So until next time, my friends, have a good couple of weeks, and I will see ya.